Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. It's 7 a.m. and today is the 7th of July.
Yes, it is 7th of July.
My name is Fung, and joining me in the studio today, we've got Julia and Fiza. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good
morning. We've had quite an exciting morning, just discussing walking around in the cold, getting up early and watching the football.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And missing my tram stop.
And missing your tram stop.
And catching my breath.
Yeah. Has this been a running theme for the last week? How's everyone going? How was the weekend?
Yeah, my sleep pattern is destroyed, so that's where I'm at.
Yes, I don't. Did you watch, for example, the Australia-Egypt game?
I did. I was up at 4 a.m. at Dukana watching it with many other Egyptian and pro-Egyptian fans.
So did you, because I was planning to watch, but I had to then be at the 3CR 50th quite early that morning, so I chose not to. But did you go to bed early, wake up for it again, or did you just stay up?
No, I after that, there were like other matches after the Egypt-Australia game. So I'm napping in between games.
It's strategic napping.
It's dysfunctional for someone who was hospitalized for exhaustion a few weeks ago. It's probably not the best lifestyle that I'm living right now.
Yeah, I feel like that's how much longer?
It's coming to an end.
Yeah, it's coming, coming to an end. Yes. We're at the knock.
We're coming. The finals is next Monday.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
No, 2 Mondays from now. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, we're up to the, what is it, the top 16.
On shift.
That's okay. Yeah, we'll get that.
We'll get that.
We'll get that as a collective.
I'll have a life again eventually. Yeah. Yes.
Julia, I saw you at the 3CR 50th anniversary on Saturday. Do you want to describe the scenes a bit for any listeners who weren't able to come?
Yeah, it was really like a lovely vibe. It felt like very like a good community connection, I felt. And it was interesting to match faces with different shows.
Yes.
I found this so exciting. Like there was lots of stalls. So you walk around and you could buy it, like get a sticker for a donation. I got a cool like Hong Kongology sticker.
They had really great.
They did.
Like buff Hello Kitty.
There you go. That's the one.
Shout out to Hong Kongology. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Matching faces to names.
Yes.
But also just like you said, like a really, really great atmosphere.
Yeah.
Bringing together listeners, people from the community, former, current presenters. In the morning I helped put up the photo wall. It was just amazing to see the station in the 70s, like all throughout the decades, the last 50 years, so from the 70s onwards. And that was really cool.
100%. That was really interesting. I was actually with Juliet looking at some photos of the Fitzroy Pools as well. I didn't realise that there was a protest at the Fitzroy Pools to prevent it from closing down. And I was thinking, wow, the Fitzroy Pools is so iconic, and I have friends who've like met there for the first time, and like it's like, wow, that's so such an awesome historic moment.
Yeah, so shout out to 3CR.
Yeah, shout out to 3CR. It was a good time.
Okay, so we've got a massive show coming up for everyone today. First up at 7:15, we'll be playing a conversation that I had with Imogen Cowan, who is one of the managing social workers in the crime team at Youth Law. We spoke last week about calls by the Victorian Police Chief Commissioner to instate mandatory minimum sentencing for young offenders. And so we talked about the impact that that would have on young people. At 7:30, we'll be talking to Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch. There has been a lot of conversation recently about Meta AI glasses. I'm sure both of you have probably seen lots of posts online about Kylie Jenner's collaboration. Yeah. So we'll be speaking in more detail about what these AI glasses actually
are.
Can't
wait for Lucinda to scare me further. That's all that happens when you interview her.
And talking about, the increasing dangers to personal privacy and safety. Just after that, we're going to listen to a very short voice message that Sana Deswat, former guest and 3CR supporter, has sent us. She and along with other women have created a local organization called Hear Her Breathe. So she's going to just speak about an upcoming permaculture course that they're running in the community.
And then at 7:45, we're going to hear from Hannah, who's an organiser with Mapuante for Palestine, as well as the upcoming Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence. And we're going to chat about what's planned for the 3 days of the convergence, including the workshops, discussions and a protest, as well as the motivations for the convergence and a little bit about the history and impact that Pine Gap has on Mapuante and the community and Northern Australia more generally.
And at 8 o'clock, we will be speaking to Rushani from Culinary, who will be speaking to us about the first culinary salon that's coming up this Saturday.
And then 8:15, we're going to be playing a pre-record from the community town hall meeting that was held to stop the AI centres from being built in the western suburbs of Melbourne.
So a massive show for everyone today. Stay tuned, though, because up next we will be giving you the news headlines for this week.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 7th of July, 2026. According to a Human Rights Watch report released yesterday, regional authorities in Tigray region of Ethiopia have been abducting and unlawfully recruiting civilians, including children, since April the 15th. People have been abducted in home raids from offices, gold mining sites, and from the streets. Human Rights Watch has confirmed 6 cases of forced recruitment following interviews this June. This follows months of rising tensions between the federal government and the largest political party in Tigray, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, who have previously fought each other in an armed conflict from 2020 to 2022. Prior to these forced abductions and recruitments, local officials in Tigray have sought to re-enlist previous Tigray Defence Force members through letters, meetings and phone calls. Letitia Bader, Deputy Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, has commented, "The Tigrayan authorities' campaign to forcibly recruit men and boys into their forces is creating a climate of fear throughout the region." She continued, "The authorities should immediately end their campaign and allow those unlawfully recruited to return home."
In other news, hundreds of people lined up around the Footscray market block over the weekend to support those affected by the earthquake in Venezuela. The community came together for an arepazo, a large-scale gathering in which people meet to eat and celebrate arepas, which is a flatbread made of maize and a staple of Venezuelan cuisine. Hosted by local restaurant Papillon and the Venezuelan Association in Australia, the event sought to raise funds for communities in Venezuela affected by last week's devastating earthquake. The fundraiser took place on Sunday from 11 a.m. at the market with the goal of making 2,000 arepas. Over 100 volunteers participated to prepare and sell the arepas to the community. The event marked one of a number of fundraisers taking place across the continent, including in Darwin, Brisbane, Geelong and Adelaide, among others.
Also in the news, the federal government's move to establish a permanent aged care advocate for First Nations people have been welcomed, with Stolen Generations advocates arguing it is a significant step towards improving outcomes for aging survivors. The government last week introduced legislation to permanently establish an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Aged Care Commissioner, describing the role as a strong independent advocate for older First Nations people. Older Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are more likely to need aged care and more likely to need it earlier. We are establishing a permanent commissioner to help close that gap, and we are listening to community to inform how we do it, Aged Care Minister Sam Ray said. This bill also strengthens protections for older people right across aged care and keeps the reforms we promised running the way they should after listening to the experiences of older people right across Australia. Responding to the announcement, the Healing Foundation, which provides support and advocacy for Stolen Generations survivors, said permanently embedding the role in legislation would help ensure the voices of First Nations people, particularly aging Stolen Generation survivors, remain central to the aged care system. Finally, in the headlines, Iran's press agencies reported millions of mourners are on the streets of Tehran for late Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei's funeral procession. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf said Tehran remains deeply at odds with the US, describing the recently signed interim deal as difficult but possible. Israel continues to kill Palestinians in Gaza, with at least 6 killed and 20 wounded in attacks. Meanwhile, in occupied Palestine, a 4-month-old Palestinian boy died in the West Bank after Israeli troops at a military checkpoint west of Ramallah prevented his transfer to a hospital. A Palestinian commission said Israeli forces and settlers have carried out 11,074 attacks across the occupied West Bank in the first half of 2026. In southern Lebanon, 4 people have been killed in an Israeli drone strike on a vehicle as the US-backed so-called ceasefire continues to be violated. The victims included the principal of Yusuf Shamoun Public School, her mother, a foreign domestic worker, and a Syrian citizen. They were checking on the family home when their vehicle was hit by a missile near Dar al-Mu'allimin, it was said. Israel military have also claimed that their troops have taken full operational control of the village of Hadatha in southern Lebanon, describing it as part of the security zone.
And finally, just wanted to note that this week is NAIDOC week, with the theme for 2026 being 50 years of deadly. This marks a milestone. It's a tribute to the people who built the movement, especially the elders who stood firm, the organisers who made space, and the artists who turned resistance into expression, as well as the communities who keep showing up year after year. In Victoria, there will be a march this Friday that will be held outside the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service. So please make sure you check NAIDOC resources online for more information. And just a reminder that 3CR has its annual Beyond the Bars broadcast, bringing you voices from the men and women inside. Yesterday, the broadcast was from Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, and today will be at Barwon starting at 11 a.m. So make sure you tune into 3CR then. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 7th of July, 2026, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 a.m.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside 6 Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganite Correctional Centre, and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions, and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to freecr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Dja Dja Rong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. Last week, I spoke to Imogen Cowan, one of the managing social workers in the crime team at Youth Law. I spoke to her about recent comments made by Victoria Police Chief Commissioner, in which she called for mandatory minimum sentencing for young offenders. In the following conversation, we spoke about how incarceration is not an effective deterrent and the collective responsibility of the community to care and provide for young people. Here is Imogen.
My name's Imogen Cowan. I am one of the managing social workers in our integrated crime team that provides holistic support to young people, meeting their legal and non-legal needs.
So we're speaking today because there's been recent calls from the Victorian Police Chief Commissioner for graduated mandatory sentencing for, quote, serious crime. Particularly among young people. I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners what the proposal is.
Yes. The Chief Commissioner has made a suggestion or a statement that in order for communities to feel safe and for young people to have serious consequences for their action, thinking of introducing mandatory minimum sentences for certain types of offences. Which would see potentially life sentences for some young people, for depending on degree of offending. And this is challenging because there is no evidence to suggest that mandatory sentencing has any deterrent impact on offending or crime, and that all the evidence suggests that the younger a young person is incarcerated, the negative effect that has and is almost a determinant that they will be seen in the adult system.
In your work at Youth Law, what have you seen in terms of the impact that being caught up in prison and heavy policing, what impact does it have on young people?
Usually what you can see is that a young person's trajectory of offending is never in isolation and doesn't come out of nowhere. Just one morning waking up, then deciding they want to do an aggravated burglary. These young people live within context and they are as a part of our communities and a product of them. And as a result, usually every one of these young people has been failed systematically by services and underserved by these. And there have been multiple drivers that have led to their offending, you know, universal experiences of trauma, child abuse, family violence, homelessness, racism, prejudice, and being excluded from school are many of the contributing factors that lead to an end result being before the criminal side of the children's court. And then once remanded, it further entrenches that, because young people will lose places at school, they might lose their jobs, they then have a stigma once they are released. And also situations that may not have been present in the community before become present as a result of having been in prison, such as feuds or groups fighting against one another, that then bleeds out into the community and almost follows them. And rather than maybe how people perceive prison to work, that you go there and you learn your lesson and you don't do it again, it isn't the case. It further cements it and entrenches it and it makes it even harder for a young person to change and escape. And then you find there's only a small portion of the population has that unique experience of having been in custody and know what that's like and how traumatizing and brutal. And so it's not bizarre that they then continue to seek one another out, because they're the only people that understand that unique experience and what they've been through, and then the consequences of it.
Thank you for that, Imogen. I feel like in that response just now, you've touched on so many things. I think one of the key issues that we often talk about when talking about the over-criminalization of people, and in this case, young people, is the, like you were just saying, the systemic injustices that they face, and compounding crises as well that are present. For example, lack of secure housing and the education system and things like that. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that when we talk about so-called community safety and trying to prevent young people from committing crimes, that the focus is always on punishment and prison time rather than addressing the root causes? I know that's maybe a bit of a challenging question.
No, I really like that question. No, I think it is a really salient point to point out. And, you know, the Chief Commissioner is right that the communities need to feel safe, and that is for all of us to uphold. But often in this conversation, when we speak about community, it speaks about as if these young people are separate to that, as if they aren't products of it, as if they aren't part of our community and therefore part of our collective responsibility. And often this discourse takes on the style of, as a culture in Australia, we are so happy and love collective responsibility and collective celebration of when things go well, and taking ownership and celebrating in our part in that. Just take the World Cup, for instance, happening right now, how much everyone's rallying behind the team and taking ownership and collective responsibility for the success and when that happens. But the inverse, whenever someone deviates from the societal norms or is seen counter to it or infringing upon it, all of a sudden it's individual responsibility. All of a sudden it's their individual choice that has led them to this. They're not a part of this. We have no responsibility in that. And frankly, it can't be both. We can't celebrate in these successes of our community, of which we all contribute to, but then not when things go wrong. And because these young people are products of our community, they are here. They, prior to being removed and placed in custody, that's where they were. And therefore, it's our sort of collective responsibility to support them within the community such that they feel a part of it and contribute positively to it. I think in the what you just raised about some of the drivers, like within the community of housing, health, and education, if we look at education as an example, if someone is struggling with literacy and numeracy, school's response is to provide extra support, to give more, to pull them close, to wrap around them, to create interventions and bring in specialists such that the young person is then able to access and thrive and engage with the curriculum and what's being asked of them. But always, whenever, as soon as it's behavior, all of a sudden it's different. All of a sudden it's, oh, well, you actually need to leave because you don't know how to behave properly, and hope that they then, in isolation, separate from others and set from a socializing and positive experience, somehow learn how to be better. And then if they come back and aren't, then removed again. And so it's the placing someone in custody is the only intervention where taking away is seen to be best, rather than providing more and wrapping around and seeking to engage with the behavior such that they can find other ways of being and coping and having their needs met.
And, you know, when we're talking about the criminalization of people, we know that often it's First Nations people and people of color who are over-policed. And so what can you talk to us about those trends there when it comes to over-policing vulnerable communities and the impact that has on them as they grow older, and their relationship to not just the police, but yeah, the broader community.
Absolutely. One of the universal things that young people I've worked with who found themselves in custody or community-based alternatives all speak from very young age about targeting and over-policing, and not just meaning policing as in the police force, but in that because of who they are and who they represent, being from either First Nations or new migrant backgrounds, they find themselves policed and monitored when they go to shopping centres, on public transport, around with police, but also in the classroom, where, depending on the cultural safety of the classrooms or how their behaviour is being perceived, they often get misinterpreted as being aggressive or intimidating when they're just sort of being loud and mucking around with one another. And just this culture and constant surveillance and suspicion, and sometimes being targeted and blamed for when they haven't actually done anything wrong, which then just sort of fuels this fire, which many of the young people I've worked with have spoken about, where they feel they're judged before they even do, and even before they've started offending, because some of them talk about, well, I'm going to be blamed anyway. I can't do anything right. I might as well go get it. And that's really disheartening and sort of cements this negative sort of perceptions, which speaks about the context and all of the sort of systemic failures and things that have let these young people down who live in our communities for a long time, leading up to when they then start being offended and charged. Mandatory sentencing removes the ability for a young person in an adolescence who's had a period of offending and time in front of the courts. It stops that from being able to be just a moment in their lives that they can, with support, grow and navigate away from. With mandatory sentencing, it guarantees and determines that that's their life forever and that they can never do more than that. And I just think that that is doing a disservice to the community.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Imogen. I think that's such a nuanced response and just goes back to this running theme throughout our whole conversation, which is that young people are part of the community. And so when we do talk about community safety, that has to include these young people as well. And like you said, imposing mandatory minimum sentencing pushes them outside of that community and tells them that they are not part of the broader collective. So thank
Absolutely.
you so much for, yeah, speaking with me today on this issue.
Thank you.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was a conversation I recorded with Imogen Cowan, one of the managing social workers in the crime team at Youth Law. In this interview, Imogen emphasised the need for more resources and funding to support wraparound services for young people rather than criminalisation. To learn more about how Youth Law supports young people, go to youthlaw.asn.au. We're going to play a song for you now. This is by the Ripple Effect Band, an all-female group hailing from Maningrida in Arnhem Land in Northern Territory, who are continuing the tradition of saltwater rock from the top end. This song comes from their album Mayawa, and it's called Banatjal.
Imra, Imra, stand strong.
Agile by Ripple Effect Band. Meta's latest AI glasses, a collaborative project with Kylie Jenner, has been met with backlash, with concerns raised about the normalization of surveillance technology, the use of celebrity endorsement to market this product to young women, and the increasing dangers to personal privacy and safety. Here to unpack this kind of AI technology is Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Welcome back to 3CR, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. I remember contacting you straight away when I was getting all of this information online about these glasses. So I really appreciate your time this morning. So as I said, Meta has just launched their latest so-called smart glasses in collaboration with Kylie Jenner. And understandably, there has been a lot of backlash in response to this, especially in the way that this wearable technology has been marketed. Can you explain to listeners how these glasses work and their purported functions?
Yeah, so the users will wear the glasses, and the glasses have built-in cameras just kind of like in the frame near the lens. They also have microphones and speakers. So when users say, "Hey Meta," the microphone in the glasses actually picks up on it and Meta's AI is activated. This means the glasses are always listening and waiting for their "Hey Meta" cue. The AI can translate, answer questions, both general questions and questions about their environment. So the AI can actually connect to the camera and scan the environment, which is crazy. The camera feature is where a lot of these privacy concerns come in. There's been at least two class actions filed because users were unaware that human Meta workers will review footage from their glasses, including, you know, really intimate moments of, like them going to the bathroom and stuff, things that you would not want to be filmed and shared. Users were unaware that the footage would be reviewed by a human, and in one of the class actions, they were unaware that that footage had even been taken.
That is very terrifying. Everyone in the studio right now was making facial expressions listening to you talk about that just now. It's incredibly scary that those glasses are always listening and always watching. We've spoken before about surveillance technology, you know, in terms of like facial recognition technology, things in supermarkets, CCTV cameras. And we've spoken specifically about the dangers that women especially would face And when we're talking about smart glasses, this is them being covertly photographed or filmed by potential abusers or stalkers. Are there any current laws or policies that exist in Australia that would protect civilians from being filmed with smart glasses?
Yes and no. So the Surveillance Devices Act is a Victorian piece of legislation which regulates how they can be used. However, there are states which are left unprotected without similar legislation. But in Victoria, the Surveillance Devices Act restricts the actions individuals can take to publish or communicate private conversations or activities recorded with Meta glasses. The maximum penalty for this is 2 years, but I don't know of any cases where such charges have actually been made. This is, of course, not to say that it's not happening. It's just that, you know, the police probably aren't investigating it to the best of their ability and the courts aren't equipped to, you know, prosecute these kinds of cases. Yeah. You can also sue someone for invading your privacy. In order to do this, you need to prove that someone has misused your personal information, which could include, like, your image, or breached your seclusion. You must also prove that you had a reasonable expectation of privacy and the breach of privacy was reckless or serious. So the privacy tool hasn't been used yet, but it looks like it could be a promising avenue for compensation for people who've been covertly filmed during intimate moments by abusive partners. However, a lot of the Meta glasses content is men talking to random women in public and trying to hit on them. Yeah. For these women, the privacy tool could actually be a less accessible route of compensation because the recording has taken place in a completely public place and the expectation of privacy, it's still there. You're not expecting to be filmed, but it's less explicit than, say, in the bedroom. Mm. You know, this is all yet to be tested in court.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Lucinda, and I'm sure there will be more information that comes out about this in the future. Early this year, following a Wired report that revealed Meta had quietly embedded facial recognition technology that they have been calling NameTag for its smart glasses into an app downloaded to millions of phones, this code was then removed, with Meta claiming that no final decision had been made. Wired reported that three AI models were found to be powering this technology called NameTag, one model to detect people's faces, one to crop them, and one to encode them into biometric data. Beyond the dangers of individuals capturing and using images and videos of others, what do we need to know about tech companies like Meta, who are collecting, storing, and possibly exploiting this data?
So once you add facial recognition, Meta glasses can identify people and turn their faces into this biometric data. And that creates like a massive surveillance issue. So they could potentially track where people are, where they were last seen, and who they were with. At scale, millions of these smart glasses could become like a kind of distributed surveillance network. And the people being captured may have never bought a Meta product, agreed to its terms, or consented to having their face turned into data. So this data would be enormously valuable to advertisers, police, intelligence agencies, and governments. I mean, you can imagine an authoritarian government asking Meta, have you seen this person? Where were they last seen? Who were they with? Now, right now, there could be like legal or technical limits on that. But Meta has consistently kissed the ring of authoritarian governments. Mm. And we shouldn't be relying on Meta's goodwill. It's a company that has a long record of treating privacy as secondary to profit. You know, it's bragged about identifying feelings of worthlessness in Australian teenagers so that it could advertise and target them. It failed catastrophically in Myanmar, where hate against the Rohingya spread across its platform to the point of a full-scale genocide. I don't believe that this is a company we should be trusting with such powerful technology. But, you know, it's not just about Meta. The real question is, you know, whether any private company should be allowed to collect, store, and exploit biometric data from people who have just never consented to it in the first place.
Mm. Thank you for that, Lucinda. And in researching for this interview today, I was reading an article on Countercurrents by Asmi Gupto, who opened their article on these glasses with the following statement. Meta's newest AI-powered eyewear, co-designed with Kylie Jenner and marketed under the name Starfire, is a useful case study in how a consumer product can extend a system of data extraction without ever appearing political, and in how celebrity endorsement functions as the mechanism that renders this extension palatable. To end our conversation today, Lucinda, how do you see celebrity endorsements like this actively minimizing and normalizing surveillance?
Look, it's a really great question, and I think that it is quite insidious of these companies to reach out to, you know, influencers and present this really dangerous technology as something which is kind of just like trendy and yeah, completely normal. You know, in this case, Kylie Jenner's audience is made up largely of young women and girls who are among the people who are most vulnerable to covert filming, image-based abuse, and unwanted surveillance. So there's something really troubling about using a woman with that level of influence to build trust in a product that could expose their audience to greater risk. I think, for me, the encouraging part, you know, the silver lining is that Meta's marketing focus on women and girls indicates that women and girls haven't bought their previous marketing. They've seen through it. And they're questioning the technology and recognizing the dangers and pushing back against the idea that constant recording should become normal. So I'm hoping that continues and they're able to see through this promotion.
Mm. And we really do appreciate you coming on our show time and time again to expose these dangers and explain them in more detail to us. So thank you again, Lucinda, for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Wired has done a lot of reporting about metaglasses and facial recognition technology. To find links to these analyses and other articles referenced in our show, head to the show notes after today's program. And for latest news and updates regarding online privacy in so-called Australia, go to digitalrightswatch.org.au. Next up, we're going to hear from Sana Deswat, who is a 3CR supporter, former guest and co-founder of the recently established local organisation Hear Her Breathe. She has sent us a short message talking about this group and their upcoming permaculture course. Take a listen.
Hi, Fong. Thank you so much for letting me talk about my little organisation on your show. So recently, me and an amazing group of women have started a little initiative called Hear Her Breathe, and it is based on the quote by Arundhati Roy, "Another world is not only possible, she's already on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." And it kind of came out of us feeling disappointed and disillusioned with fighting the big political beast that wasn't budging and wasn't helping to create the world we need for a better future. And so we decided to focus on things that we can do on a local level. And one of the things that we are thinking of doing is creating courses in which we share skills that people can help people to build a more resilient community and more resilient households in the face of climate change, as well as cost of living or cost of war, crises, and other things that might be coming our way. So we are currently working with a woman to work on her garden and create a permaculture therapeutic haven for her. And we're also starting to run our first course, which is called Building Resilient Households and Communities Through a Permaculture Lens, and that will be taking place in Fairfield in the community room from the 14th of July on Tuesdays, 14th of July until August 25th, which is six Tuesdays with one break in the middle. They will be running from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. and we really want to make this knowledge available to everyday people rather than designing rich people's gardens. So we want to keep it affordable for people, and we want to make the course really interactive and practical so that people walk away with a skill and a design of their solutions in their own place. It focuses on low-tech and slow solutions that we are already having today, and really draws from the knowledge in the group as well. So I'm really looking forward to starting this, and I will send through a code and a link to the course that people can book in, and a code that 3CR listeners can have a 20% discount to the course, because we really want to get the community involved and hope that more people will join in. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sana Deswat speaking about Hear Her Breathe, a new organisation made of women wanting to build community resilience in the face of climate change and other intersecting crises. To find out more, go to hearbreathe.wordpress.com, and 3CR listeners can get a 20% discount to the upcoming permaculture course by entering the code 3CR202620. Go to our show notes for more details after the program.
Hannah again is an organiser with Mabantwa for Palestine, as well as the upcoming Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence. This year marks 60 years since the signing of an agreement to build an American military base on Arunta country. Hannah called in from Mabantwa last night to speak to me about what's planned for the 3 days of the convergence, including workshops, discussions, and a protest. We discussed the motivations for this year's convergence and the impact that Pine Gap has on Mabantwa and its community and what it means about the broader Australia-US security alliance. Here is that interview. Thank you so much for joining us, Hannah, on Tuesday Breakfast. To start off, could you just quickly introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. My name is Hannah, and I am part of a group called Mbantwa for Palestine in Mbantwa, Alice Springs, an island country here in Central Australia. And I am one of the organising group who are putting on the Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence between July 18th and 20th in Central Australia.
Could you start off by telling our listeners why the convergence is taking place and maybe give a bit of context about what Pine Gap actually is?
So, yeah, I guess the convergence is called Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back because people may have heard of the Pine Gap US spy base, which is about 20 kilometres from Alice Springs. And it has been a target of protest basically since it was first put there nearly 60 years ago, because that it is kind of, an integral part of US imperialism that operates here out of Central Australia. It has been used for a number of things over its life. It's part of the Five Eyes sort of surveillance facility that the US has, which enables it to do things like target drones that it uses to kill people in West Asia. It has been used to gather intelligence. It's been shared with Israel in the genocide in Gaza, and has generally been a key way by which the US maintains its aggressive imperial dominance over the globe. And because of that, and also historically, because, and I think relevant again now, the Pine Gap, having Pine Gap so close to Alice Springs makes us historically a nuclear target in the context of the Cold War. And as, we see an increasingly unstable world and we see the US building up a military presence in North Australia and the potential increasing sort of possibility of some kind of war between the US and China, it once again is also something that puts people living here at risk.
It is so scary the more and more you think about it, just how much the US is using, that base and putting Northern Australia at risk. And maybe that leads into ask a bit about why you were motivated to get involved in Mbantwa for Palestine, and particularly with the convergence.
I've been organizing with this group, Mbantwa for Palestine, for the last few years, and since the group formed, Pine Gap has been a big focus, because if you live here, that seems like the most obvious connection that we have. The biggest kind of, I guess, sense of complicity that we have is hosting this base. A lot of people, who work for the base live in town. It's, the stone throw away. It's very visible. And so we have talked for quite some time about the idea of having a convergence here and inviting people to come from across the continent. And in the past 6 months, we have been talking to the custodians of Coonba, the region where Pine Gap is occupying, and sort of came to this idea that it would be good to invite people and have, I guess, both to talk about that place and also custodians call for that land to be returned to them. And also, I guess, we're at this moment, the war on Iran and an increasingly unpredictable US, where it feels like we're in a moment where, after several years of a very energized movement for solidarity with Palestine, there's sort of questions about where to from here. And I think that a lot of people who've been involved, like I have, in organizing locally, a really good opportunity for us to come together, to share learnings, to talk about what the key threats are and what we are fighting against and also what we're fighting for. I think that is something that feels really needed, and the feedback that we've had. So we've had really incredible response from kind of locally, whether it's like the family who speak for that country, people locally in town, people from interstate wanting to come. I guess I get the strong sense that lots of people feel like now is the time to be doing this. And that's why we're organising the convergence.
Yeah, definitely. I know there's quite a few people from 3CR actually coming from NAM to Mpantwa to participate in the convergence. Awesome. Which is, super exciting. So, but could you tell us a bit about what is planned for the 3 days during the convergence?
People will be camping together, arriving on the Friday. We'll have a bit of an orientation and hear a little bit about the history of protest at that site. Then we will have a couple of days of kind of like a bit of a conference style proceeding with some like plenary talks that are kind of big talks bringing together some of the key themes. So on Saturday morning, we've got one about sort of struggles against colonialism and imperialism here and abroad, with some really amazing speakers. Catherine Gilby, who's a Liaora academic from Central Australia, Ahmed Adam, who's a Sudanese writer who lived for a long time here and is talking about the kind of, I guess, the way that colonialism in Africa is connected to here. Rima Naji, who's been a really strong organizer in Brisbane with Justice for Palestine. And then we're going to have a series of kind of more like workshop style events. Some of them will be focusing on First Nations struggles locally for housing against the racialized crime panic. And some of them will be more skills focused, like one on storytelling, one on union organizing, sharing the knowledge that we have, and also, the skills we want to develop. And then on the second day, we've got a bit of a where to from here plenary in the morning. We'll talk about some of the kind of contemporary struggles. We've got Karina Lester talking about her work, talking about AUKUS, and the fight to ongoing sort of challenges around nuclear disarmament. We've got Senator David Shoebridge speaking about kind of the parliamentary struggles that he's been involved in and things that he's found out through, his using Senate estimates and these kind of parliamentary methods to grill the government. And we'll be hearing from Anisu Hasseldine, who's a Gugatha woman who's been campaigning against basically rocket launches on her country. We've got a bit of a deep dive on Pine Gap and on the military build-up in North Australia, the Anti-Semitism Royal Commission, and what, I guess, kind of the politics of intentional conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and what that means for people struggling in solidarity with Palestine. And then we'll have a bit of a where to from here session where we kind of think together about how we can come together as a stronger, more connected movement. On the Monday, we'll have a day of action. And I won't tell you too much of the details about that, but you might be able to imagine, as someone who lives in Central Australia, where it's, pretty far away, transient population in some ways, but still far away, that's something that's really exciting for me, is the chance to get more connected with people and learn from the ways that people are working all across this continent.
Yeah, it really sounds like it'll be such a huge opportunity for knowledge sharing and bringing people together in solidarity and across a range of different movements as well. So
totally.
It sounds like such a, a really powerful weekend ahead next week. And obviously, want to keep a lot of the protest under wraps. Would you be able to speak to what some of the aims of what you're hoping for out of protesting against Pine Gap?
The Pine Gap facility is both in itself something that plays a terrible role in the world and needs to be closed. And we want to raise awareness of the fact that that base exists and what it's doing. And also, I think it is a bit of a stand-in more broadly for the alliance with the US and Australia's, the Australian government's pattern of just following the US into any, imperial excursion that wants to go on. In doing so, also like following the US into a more violent era. And historically, the US government has said in the past that the Pine Gap facility is the most important aspect of the military alliance between the US and Australia. It's the one they're most attached to, and that this is one of the most significant overseas US bases outside of Guam, the most significant. So it's really about both making that visible, because one of the reasons that they chose to put it in Central Australia in the first place is that they thought it was out of sight and out of mind for most people on this continent. And they thought that Alice Springs was a safe place that didn't have many communists. So I think we want to show that, in fact, both we have a very mobilised local population who are aware of this base and want to see it gone, and also more broadly eyes are on what's happening on Central Australia. And I also see it as something that's emblematic of, that tells a bigger story about the appalling way that the Australian government is complicit in the violence that the US and its allies, including us, are doing in various places, and also to kind of, I guess, gesture at a desire that is, that, you know, we might be the more organised end of that, but I think a lot of ordinary people who aren't part of movements across Australia are, like, increasingly questioning whether we want to be part of this alliance, or whether there are other ways Australia can be in the world.
It sounds like a lot of people, yeah, both in Central Australia and more broadly across the continent, will be thinking about these big questions. And I think there is a lot of resistance across the community. So hopefully the convergence really highlights that and sends a strong message. Before we wrap up, is there anywhere that people can go to find out more information about the convergence?
Absolutely. Probably the best thing, we have a website. It's called closepinegap.org.au. Where you can see the full program. You can register if you want to come on Instagram, Mbantwa for Palestine, or Aman, which is the anti-militarist action network, I believe, are two Instagram accounts that are sharing a lot of content about the convergence and people involved in it, messages of support, etc.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Hannah. And yeah, definitely we'll encourage people to head online to find out more.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation between myself and Hannah, an organiser for the upcoming Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence, taking place next weekend from 18th to 20th of July in Mabantwa, Alice Springs. And to find out more information, you can go to closepinegap.org.au or on Instagram, Mabantwa_4_Palestine and Aman_Anti-Militarism Network.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Melbourne Documentary Film Festival returns to Cinema Nova from July 7 with Documentaries Reimagined. Warm up the cold winter days with an eclectic program of local and international documentaries from independent and emerging talents. Proudly ranked among Film Freeway's top 100 festivals worldwide for 11 consecutive years, Melbourne Documentary Film Festival delivers stories that stay with you long after the credits roll. Screening from July 7 for a limited time at Cinema Nova, 380 Lygon Street, Carlton. 3CR sponsor.
I sang the words I will not say, so.
Hey, this is Greta Ray, and you are listening to 3CR 855 AM Radical Radio on digital and streaming live on 3cr.org.au.
Rushani Ipa is a Sri Lankan and Australian food and travel journalist, editor, and literary agent. Her work focuses on global dining, identity, and the cultural narratives that shape food and hospitality. She's joining us today to speak about Culinary Salon and its upcoming event, Kamahia, a literary food salon exploring Palestinian and Lebanese foodways. Good morning, Rushani, and welcome to Tuesday Breakfast.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I'm really excited for this Culinary Salon. But yeah, to start us off with me, tell us more about culinary specifically, of course. And then, what is it and why did you create this platform and event?
Definitely. So we started in 2020. Mm-hmm. I'm a journalist by trade, and I actually myself wanted to become a food journalist and just found it really difficult to kind of break into the industry. At the time, it very much felt like it was all about who you knew. And so I created Culinary just as a magazine, I suppose. It was basically a glorified blog. And then when I slapped the word magazine on it, it started to get attention, which was great. But ever since then, it kind of, we've gone on to print two issues. And we've been kind of more or less dormant for the last few years as we rebranded and really figured out our purpose again. Because times have obviously shifted since 2020. But we've just relaunched across Australia and the UK. We're very much targeted towards the diasporas, and we are still focused on the global majority and our foods and cultures. But we're going for a bit more of a digital approach, but also videos and events that can bring the communities together. That's what we're doing at the moment. And so this Culinary Salon is the first of our series of events that we're relaunching with, which should be exciting. I am a former publisher and I'm current literary agent by trade, so very much involved in publishing, which is where the books kind of angle came into place. So the Culinary Literary Salon is a literary food salon.
Which sounds delightful and delicious, but also fairly new concept. Could you explain more? What exactly is a literary food salon?
Yeah, 100%. So we did take some inspiration from this amazing food journalist in London, Anna Sullen-Massing. She also had a series of Sunday salons, which I highly recommend anyone looking into. But this is basically a way for us to talk about whether it's food-based literature or literature that can touch on food, and also offer guests the opportunity to eat while we discuss big kind of issues. I've always, like, one of the biggest reasons why I created Culinary was because I've always been interested in politics, and I think food is an incredibly powerful way of discussing politics, you know, and you can really invite someone to take a seat at the table and break bread together. And so that's what the Literary Food Salon is based on, kind of literary salons, which were huge during, like, the Enlightenment era of the French Revolution as well, providing spaces for people to come and engage in critical discourse, discuss literature, and network as well, and just provide that kind of safe space. And that's what we're effectively trying to do with these salons, with different themes.
Am I right to say this Saturday is the first salon? Is that correct? Saturday salon, which of course is fascinating, and I'm very, very excited to be attending it as well. It's focusing on the question of the role of cultural preservation, because obviously specifically we are talking about the food cultures of Lebanon and Palestine. And so this question of cultural preservation in a time of genocide and erasure, but more interestingly as well, this idea of the evolution of this cultural cuisine, right, as it is being introduced and explored in new spaces by people in the diaspora. Could you maybe talk us through that central question, I guess, and why that is the focus of this first Culinary Salon?
Yeah, definitely. I think first and foremost, we really wanted to provide a safe space to people within those diasporas and then allies as well to engage in discourse around this theme. It just feels like it's just more needed now than ever. I don't know, it doesn't seem like there's many spaces like that in the mainstream. The purpose of this salon is to really focus on a question and a topic that's very, very big at the moment in food, and I think it's authenticity, and the other one is also appropriation. And what we're trying to do through speaking with the likes of Lebanese Australian journalist Anton Issa, who just released his book Rebirth, which focuses on and chronicles his mother's experiences during the Lebanese war when it started in Beirut, and her journey to Melbourne, and then also speaking with Rahaf Al-Khatib, who runs Beit City, which is the Palestinian Cafe and Cultural Centre. We've got two really different kind of experiences, opinions, but also these are people that have spent most of their lives in Australia.
Yes, exactly.
You know, despite having those cultural connections as well, and that's where it gets really interesting because when we're constantly talking about Palestine and now Lebanon too, we're really faced with a lot of images of war, especially in the West.
And
photos of the genocide and this looming threat of erasure. But what we really need to also focus on are the beauties of these cultures and the rich cultures and cuisines that are behind them.
Absolutely.
Speaking to people with lived experiences about how do you think we can preserve them, preserve the traditions, but also through experiences of people like Rahaf and Tun who have, you know, spent most of their lives in Australia, how do we allow your cuisines and cultures to evolve naturally for people like you? You know, without kind of pigeonholing them, stereotyping them, which is
absolutely
at the very crux of the issue with now modern-day authenticity. And so it's really like acknowledging how authenticity is very much an individual thing and a very individual lived experience.
And I think that's an easy trap, I guess, in a sense, to fall into, you know, the trap of cultural purity, in a sense, you know, especially when we start talking about cultural preservation. And and something I've always believed is that culture is not a thing you can preserve, or, you know, it's not set in stone. It's an evolving culture is alive. Culture is a practice, right? So there's no really a concept of like, oh, there is the pure culture or the correct culture in a sense, you know, whereas like you live and breathe it, and then, you know, you carry it with you when you move to new spaces, like what Antun and Rahaf has done, you know, by carrying their cultures with them into the new spaces they're in. And I know for a fact that Rahaf is doing incredible things with Beit City, both in food wise you know, she has this stunning pomegranate Danish that I'm labneh pomegranate Danish that I'm obsessed with. You know, and I remember when she first opened, she was getting quite a bit of backlash, I guess, on some level about how the food wasn't like, this is not real Palestinian food, or, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like, she's a Palestinian making food. It's Palestinian food, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, and this really extends to many people. I'm sure many of us in different diasporas have experienced similar kind of feedback, right? And that's what we kind of want to tackle head on as well as part of the salon. Just really acknowledging that ownership to us is, it's individual.
I mean, that being said, I am Singaporean, and so there are places in Melbourne that I simply do not eat their laksa because it's just the wrong kind of noodles. I'm sorry, but that is the hill I will die on.
I love that.
You've got to have boundaries.
No, 100%. You've got to have boundaries. And, you know, and then there's the other side wherein sometimes the people are looking, like, I'm Sri Lankan heritage, and sometimes you go to restaurants where they're really trying to dilute flavors to cater to a Western palate.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I think that's where the defensiveness comes in.
Exactly. So the question, I think, ultimately is, like, who are you serving?
Yes, who is this absolutely. For? Yes, who's your audience?
Exactly.
And I guess, this is the thread that's running through all of us. And this is a conversation I obviously have a lot, because I think it's also funny how I think sometimes when you're in the diaspora, food suddenly becomes so powerful as a cultural identity, political, you know, marker in a sense. But food and politics and belonging, right, has always been intertwined. So I'm really excited that it's going to be explored in this way. I guess maybe you could share, you kind of started touching on it a bit, like, what do you feel is a culturally distinct Sri Lankan dish, I guess, that holds cultural significance for you?
I think this is a really good question. I think for me personally, I'm Sinhalese. Yeah. I grew up in a Buddhist family, so I kind of fit the mold of, I don't know, what some might deem to be quite typical. But so for me, like, growing up, it was dal. Probably quite a common answer for many Sri Lankans across the board, because that's what my mum would make for me. It's my comfort meal. It's my, like, death row meal, you know, it's everything. But what I would say is that Sri Lanka is made up of so many distinct cultural and absolutely. Religious groups. You know, we've got the Vada, we've got Tamil, Malay, Burger, Sinhalese, and it's really important to recognise how we've all kind of shaped the cuisine. And absolutely. We recently filmed a culinary documentary at the start of this year in Sri Lanka and the north. And I don't know if you know much about Sri Lanka, but there was a big bloody civil war. And unfortunately, Tamil people, there were genocides committed against them by the Sri Lankan government. And so we went up there and we focused on native crops because of looking at climate, observing climate change, particularly in an area at the north, which was really war-torn, the impact climate change is now having on them. As to what they already faced with the war is horrible. So we really need to encourage the use of native crops. And so, anyway, palmara would be my answer. Palmara is a palm tree that grows really easily in the north. It's like a symbol of resistance and survival for the people in Jaffna, the Tamil people in Jaffna. During the war, when, you know, food supplies were banned or banned access to them, this was what was helping them to build shelters to supply food and nutrition for them and their families. And it's just incredible. Like, you can eat all these different parts. Like, there's the fruit that you can eat. There's the tuber that you can eat. You can dry the tuber to make flour or chips. There's all these different kind of uses for it. And I thought it was amazing because, like, where my mum is from, down the south of the country, they know next to nothing about this incredible plant. And so I would say, yeah, definitely the palmara, I think, is the most culturally distinct dish for me at the moment. In terms of its power and what it represents.
Absolutely. And I love that, you know, this idea of like sustainable eating and sustainable farming has actually been very much alive and well in many, many indigenous cultures, right, for centuries. And it's not exactly like a newfangled thing that it's been purported to be. So, yeah, incredible. I can't wait to hear all these things are being surfaced, I'm sure, this coming Saturday. I guess to wrap us up, could you maybe then just share a bit more details about the event this Saturday, where listeners can maybe get tickets or more further details, and also, where proceeds are going towards and so on?
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much. So, firstly, thank you for having us on the show. And secondly, I'd say that the event, it's going to take place in Coburg at Bukena. Tickets are currently available. If you hop onto Culinaries, which is Coulinary, our Instagram, you can find all the information. Otherwise, we have tickets available on Try Booking, but there's also a link in our bio. The event will take place from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Guests can expect a full Lebanese-Palestinian feast by Bake City and A1 Bakery. Each guest gets a gift as well from Six-Eyed Scorpion, the chili oil brand. We'll have books sold by Brunswick Bound, full kind of array of Lebanese and Palestinian literature, a panel chat by Antun and Rahaf, moderated by myself, and then that'll kind of go into lunch. And then we want the audience to be involved, and we'll have an audience discussion as well. And then we'll also have a raffle raising funds for grassroots mutual aid in Palestine and also for a soup kitchen in Beirut via Nation Station. Those are the details. We'd love to see anyone there. We also have discounted tickets available for those of the community that can't afford the full price. You just need to reach out to us. But all the information is on our Instagram.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. Thank you ever so much, Roshani. It was also a delight to have you on the show. And I really look forward to meeting you this Saturday. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Riza. The feeling is totally mutual. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Roshani, sharing more about Culinary's first salon, Kamahia, that will be taking place this Saturday at Dukana in Coburg from 11 to 1 p.m. For more details, please check out at Culinary on Instagram, and we will also include the link to purchase tickets in our show notes. As mentioned, the proceeds will contribute to mutual aid in Palestine and Lebanon, so do consider donating even if you might not be able to attend the event.
That was such a beautiful conversation, Lisa, touching on so many different things. And just an opportunity to sort of like, I don't know, pause and connect with community.
Yeah, and I also feel like, yeah, I think the point she was making about, like, I think sometimes it's so easy to get caught up in trauma porn in the time of such suffering and pain, and then we forget that there's other aspects of the culture that is very much alive. It's not just, you know, oh, it's a struggle to keep it alive. It's literally alive and breathing.
It's living.
It's living, exactly. And you know, we lose sight of that, I think, if we get too stuck on the, you know, the bodies, you know, as opposed to the, the living.
But also simultaneously acknowledging that there are horrific things that are happening in the world, and doing these sorts of things that are still contributing to mutual aid, and making sure that we're actively coming together
For being in community.
Well, before our last segment today, we're going to play we might just actually go straight to the next segment.
Okay. A meeting was held at the community town hall to stop the AI data centres from being built in the western suburbs of Melbourne, specifically Plumpton. The proposed data centre has been named the Victorian AI Hub and is estimated to be 350 hectares in size and contains detrimental impacts upon the community, including upon biodiversity corridors and endangered vegetation. Here is a pre-recorded speech from the rally with both Hong Truong and Greens candidate Brittany Henderson speaking. And thank you to Amy from 3CR's Kill Your Lawn for sharing these recordings.
First of all, we're not alone in this. And I'm feeling that in a really big way. Hands up if you learnt something that you didn't know before tonight. Right. So that tells me that between us, we can work out how to stop these things.
Yes.
What I'm hearing is there's concern about the actual data center, the process that has meant that we're landed with it, and then the question mark about who's looking after our interests when this thing is put together. Because, you know, the government and the corporations have a form of dumping things on us. And so we're really worried that if we don't stop this, then we might be copying things like consequences for generations for the sake of billionaires and trillionaires that don't even go here. We're also worried about the environmental immediate impacts on the communities that live here, but then also the biodiversity, the livability of this place. There's a massive question about who are these data centres for? Why do we even need to have this conversation when no one's asked for it, no one asked us if we want it? And so there's a really huge question about the social license that David mentioned earlier. I'm also hearing that we can learn a lot from what's happening elsewhere. I know that personally that there are places in Australia that are fighting data centres too, but also we know that there are places that have fought and won, and we'll hear about them a little bit tonight. And we're hoping to be that mob. What else have we got? We're worried about surveillance. We're worried about what this means for democracy. They just can just come in and dump a data centre on us and think that we won't put up a fight. And the immediate impacts of fire risk, air pollution, noise pollution, as our poor neighbours in West Footscray are already experiencing. Have I missed anything? Property values. For those of us who can't afford property, that's a bad time.
Flood and bushfire.
The flood and bushfire as well, in terms of like how it doesn't make sense. So there's also a question about we're worried about what we don't know. Okay, last comments and we might move on.
Something that I found out today was that there are superannuations that are funding, they're putting shares towards this. I think there should be, maybe that fits into a bit more, so we're a bit aware of that and the decisions we make in superannuation.
There seems to be a sentiment in the room that if people want to make profit off of the resources and of our community, that we've got some boundaries. It's not a free-for-all. If you're not going to benefit, if you're actually going to be harmful, we don't want you here. Yeah. Military, surveillance, all that sort of stuff. We're not interested in supporting an industry that causes harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Congratulations, everyone. I think you did more than the government. This was an idea that some incredible tech people who are far smarter than I could ever be said that we could do, and I think it's really important that, you know, we're all here because the community wasn't consulted with any of this. And so we did some thinking on how we can visually show that. And so what we were thinking was, everyone has their own grounding reason for being here, why they oppose these AI data centers. Mine is that the Plumpton site sits on the bones of a bunch of Aboriginal artifacts. Most people wouldn't know what they were looking at, but I do when I went out there. There's hundreds of Aboriginal artifacts that are going to be destroyed by a block of concrete. And so that's my grounding reason, but you all have your own grounding reasons as we went through, and you potentially have more or different ones that you've heard in the room. And so if you would like to, that's me, so if we're talking about where your data's going, it's to me. And we can put it on a big map. So similar to what's going on here, is you'll visually be able to tell your story through this map. And so then we can take it to decision makers and say, hey, this is actually what the community has said and why they want to oppose this thing. So you're welcome to text me, just include your name. It doesn't have to be your real name. I'm happy if it's an alias. Your postcode or like your suburb, like I don't need to know where exactly where you live, but just so we can visually put it somewhere here. And why you don't want this data center. And while people do that, I might ask if anyone has any questions, because I think it's important that people are kind of... Yeah.
On that, this is a question or a statement, but on top of all the other absurdities that we've already listed, which is total insanity, like I live in Yarraville, but I was driving for where, because that's where I work, so yeah. Coming through the back blocks and whatever, you can see that there's all these grand new communities that they're building. The very areas that they're selecting for these stupid data centres, in addition, are the prime land properties where they're expanding the communities. That's an oxymoron. The whole thing is beyond absurd. You're selling out the land to the people who want the data centres, so now nobody can buy land to build. But then the areas you flagged that we're going to expand our grand community so everybody has a home. And you're going to blame the small landlord owners while they're, and nobody, this is a little bit of an aside, but it kind of ties in with this, while they've fast-tracked the budget and given BlackRock and these five other, whatever the other World Economic Forum organisations are, a 50% discount on them building these monoliths of properties and, you know, like apartment buildings, you know, slam the small holders. You flag communities to be built in these areas where they're now going to dump data centres. And like we said, with the actual increase of the temperature of these, even before the data centres, I'm just going to give a very brief outline, like how I mentioned the towers. A couple of summers ago, I visited a friend in downtown. Midsummer, it was 32 degrees. We went outside, went to Woods to get something. When I drove away from there, and this is, you know, everyone's talking about coal fire burning, you know, it's the evil. It's actually not. Bulldozing every tree that you can find your hands on to put this crap on top of that, all these 5G towers, they emit so much heat and radiation as well. When I left Little Collins Street, by the time I drove to Vic Market, there was a 6-degree drop in temperature. This has nothing to do with normal global warming. It has nothing to do with coal. It's got to do with all of these 5G towers and the data centers, which are raising temperatures between 6 and 9 degrees. Therein lies our problem. And you can put it on a place that's going to burn in the middle of a fire anyway, because it's the hottest place in Victoria. This is like complete insanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree the planning laws are pretty cooked, that this could be fast-tracked. I also just want to say that in that, I think it's a really big myth that there's lots of trees in the West. There were never trees here. That's not true. There were trees,
well,
but it was never a popular...
We're talking about their trees, but like pummeling the globe, and in order to build these data centres, in order to have all these microchips, they need cadmium, zinc, and all these other rare minerals. Guess where they're found? They're found in the native forests of the South Americas. They're also decimating Tasmania to actually mine all this stuff. Most of this stuff only has 5 to 10 year lifespan, even with the lithium batteries. Everybody wants electric cars. all the solar panels, where are you going to put them? It's just toxic waste upon toxic waste. The whole thing's just an upside down argument. And they're destroying the West. I've lived in the West all my life. And you're right, it's a dumping ground. I don't see any of these data centres being built in Turak.
Yeah.
It's
true. I just heard people get weird about when I said trees, and so not related to you, I just want to clarify. The West is home to like grasslands and shrubbery.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so I'm like, just so if no one comes out and says that the Greens candidate is anti-tree. But like, I think it really scares me when people don't recognise the importance of the wetlands that were built on top of the grasslands, the shrubbery that do a lot.
Well, the tree planting objectives are miserably failing at the moment because they're planting trees in a grassland.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay, cool. All right, we might hear no.
You have been listening to speeches from Hung Truong and Brittany Henderson from the meeting to stop the Plumpton AI data centre, which is being planned for Melbourne's West. To find out more, you can visit their Facebook page, which we will put in the podcast show notes. And you can listen to the Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence 3CR show every Friday from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m.
Yeah, and shout out to Amy, who always does incredible reporting for that show and for a bunch of other shows as well on 3CR. We are nearing the end of our program for today. And before we give you a rundown on what we had on today's show, just a couple of events to keep an eye out for this week. As we talked about earlier, this Friday, the 10th of July, there will be a NAIDOC march for NAIDOC Week. That's taking place from 9:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. So meet at the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service, which is located at 186 Nicholson Street, Fitzroy.
And this Saturday is the Culinary Salon, discussing the cuisine and culture of the Levant. That will be at Dukana in Coburg from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.
So we had a massive show today. First up, we listened to an interview that I had with Imogen Cowan, who is one of the managing social workers at Youth Law. We spoke about the impacts that mandatory minimum sentencing would have on young people. At 7:30, we spoke to Lucinda Thorpe about AI glasses and the lack of privacy that would leave civilians in the community. And after that, we listened to a brief message from Sana Deswat, who is the co-founder of Hear Her Breathe. She spoke to us about the upcoming permaculture course that they're having.
And then at 7:45, we listened to an interview with Hannah Akin, an organiser with Babantwa for Palestine, as well as the upcoming Closed Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence. We spoke about what's planned for the upcoming convergence next weekend and why there is a need for this convergence this year a bit about what impact Pine Gap has on the community and on the continent more broadly.
And at 8 a.m. we spoke to Roshani, a food and travel journalist, sharing more about Culinary's first salon, Kamakia, which will be taking place this Saturday, and is going to be exploring Palestinian and Lebanese food ways.
And then at 8:15, we listened to a meeting from the community town hall to stop the AI data centres from being built in the western suburbs. And we heard speeches from Hung Truong and Brittany Henderson.
That's all we have time for on today's program. Up next is Accent of Women. And just a reminder that this week for NAIDOC Week, we are having the annual Beyond the Bars broadcast here on 3CR. Today, that broadcast will be from Barwon Prison out near Geelong. That's starting at 11 a.m. and finishing at 2 p.m. So make sure you tune into 3CR for that. But until then, we will see you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to www.3cr.org.au.